Yes, we all want to succeed. Yes, Adam Smith is correct that people at the end of the day pursue money and greed. But if you really want to rally the troops, if you really want to make a change, it starts from the spirit. It starts from liberal arts. It starts from the why. Why am I doing what I'm doing?
Welcome to 20 Minute Leaders. Just sit back, relax, and learn from the leaders of today. It's a journey. Each one is different, unique, inspiring. Let's get started. This episode is powered by J Ventures, a community-driven VC fund in Silicon Valley in partnership with Leumi Tech, sponsored by Hippo Insurance, Opwest Labs, Turing, Hillel at Stanford, Leap, and in media partnership with C-Tech. We are in the Aleph offices in Tel Aviv, and I'm joined today by Michael Eisenberg, an equal partner at Aleph, an early-stage venture capital fund with over $500 million under management. Aleph focuses on partnering with great Israeli entrepreneurs to build large, meaningful companies and impactful global brands. Since its founding in 2013, Aleph has invested in more than 40 companies, including Melio, Lemonade, Bring, Joytunes, Healthy.io, and Nexar. Meet Michael.
Michael Eisenberg, how are you doing?
Good, how are you? I would hit you with this hand, but I just got my cast and pin out.
Well, thank you for treating me here at the Aleph offices. This is just beautiful. I've been here about 6 or 7 years ago with Ron, and I'm friends with Ed, and now I'm friends with you. So thank you for inviting me. And I'm excited to talk to you about your amazing career, both with Benchmark and with Aleph, as an amazing investor and thinker. But you're not just an investor. You're a father of six.
No, I'm a father of eight, actually.
You're a father of eight?
Yeah.
We have to change the LinkedIn summary.
The blog wasn't scalable. The blog title wasn't scalable.
I have to start by asking, how do you get everything done? What? How do you think through your sort of life or your day to day? Because you do so much.
I've said this before. I don't believe in this elusive notion of work-life balance. I think it's a false promise we make to people. Nothing is ever in balance, neither in life nor in the world. We live in a constant state of imbalance or are out of balance. And so I think what we all actually strive to do is we try to be the best in our family life, which is the most important, obviously. We try to be, you know, the best in our professional life. Hopefully, we try to be the best in our charitable, philanthropic life. And we try to merge all those. They're not separate islands. We try to merge them. So something always has to give. And I say to my kids all the time, there can only be one thing at the top of your priority list at any given time. And you got to give your time to that. And so that's what you do. So how do I get things done? I don't know. But I give you the most important secret to all that is I married really well. My wife's amazing. And that's how I get a lot done.
Now, do you still live in Jerusalem, right?
I do. I live in Jerusalem.
We're in Rothschild, in Tel Aviv. You have eight children. You're sitting on the boards of some of the most incredible companies in the world. And so something doesn't add up. I understand this idea of balance, but it's still, then how do you decide what do you do? You're sitting here with me. How do you decide what is the priority?
I have a schedule, and then it gets out of whack. So I get up very early in the morning. I'm a morning person. I'm a bit of an insomniac. Like, I have a hard time sleeping. I'm trying to get better at that. It's not going that well.
Well, from the amount of energy that I'm seeing, I think you're fine.
I get up early. I go to synagogue first thing in the morning, and then I sit down and I have a Bible, a Torah study time because I've been writing books. I just published my fifth book.
Wow.
And I'm working on the sixth now. And so that's my morning time. Get my kids out along with my wife, although they're all kind of old enough right now that they more or less get themselves out themselves. The younger three kids are living at home. The others have moved out for one reason or another. And then I come to work in Tel Aviv and, you know, do meetings. I learn by meeting people and by doing. I read a fair amount, but I learn more by meeting people and speaking to interesting people like you. That's how I learn. So the more meetings, the better.
So you've been an internet investor since
95.
Since the dawn of the internet.
Yeah.
But I was planning on going that direction, but first I have to talk about Judaism and values and waking up every morning. You know, with the tight schedule, with eight kids, with all these investments, you still find time for the things that you're passionate about and you believe in. Does that conflict in any way?
I think the world of values, morals, ethics, and spirituality is really what drives the human soul at the end of the day. Yes, we all want to succeed. Yes, Adam Smith is correct that people at the end of the day pursue money and greed. But if you really want to rally the troops, if you really want to make a change, it starts from the spirit. It starts from liberal arts. It starts from the why. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And the why I'm doing what I'm doing goes back to a few things. One very important one is a conversation I had. I was in like a press conference with a rabbi many years ago. And what's funny is my wife would tell you, I'm not that into rabbis, but he was a special man. And I once asked him if I decided to move to Israel, and I wasn't planning on it at the time. I was 19, right before my 20th birthday. And I moved to like an unpopulated place. Israel is about a third the number of people as it is now, you know, the Negev, the Galilee. Or I moved to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, a big city. Is that kind of the same reason or raison d'etre to move here? And he looked at me and says, it's all nonsense. That's nonsense. You need to move to Israel and build a factory that will employ 10,000 people to earn an honest and decent living. And I said, whoa, that is a spiritual reason for economic development.
Yeah.
People need to earn an honest and decent living. And at that moment, I decided to move to Israel. And I would create 10,000 jobs. That's become, you know, my life goal. And if we get to 10,000, we'll create 100,000 jobs so people can earn an honest and decent living. And that is a spiritual calling, in my view, and one that needs to be buttressed and undergirded with ethics, morals, and values and spirituality, because that's how bonds are formed.
Right.
Bonds are not. They're formed by working together. I write about this in my most recent book. When we work together, when we toil together, when we build something together, we form bonds. But we also need a values layer underneath it to be able to sustain and nourish those bonds.
Wow. Well, I think just by looking at just three or four of the companies that are immediately jumping into my head, you've already created many more than 10,000 honest and decent jobs in the state of Israel and the world in general.
I'll tell you a funny story. At the rabbi's 80th birthday party, I'd never talked about this until then. Never. And they asked me to come tell the story at his 80th birthday. It wasn't a party. It was like a big lecture. It's like 2,000 people in the audience, all his former students. And I get up there and I see he's got like this smile, this mischievous smile on his face. And I get up and I tell the story. And he looks at me and says, "New, how many jobs have you created?" And I said, "I don't think 10,000 yet." He says, "Well, get down from the stage and get back to work."
Amazing.
So
amazing.
Yeah.
And so when you, going back 26 years, it's 1995. What do you think to yourself? Is this the vision where we are right now?
Oh, I don't know. You know, the Talmud says that since the temple was destroyed, there is no prophecy, and anyone who tries to prophesy is a fool. So I don't think we knew, you know, in 95, what this internet was going to become. The first investment I made in an internet company called Picture Vision was for photo sharing. It was a values thing. I had moved to Israel. My family was living in America. My wife's family was living in America. We had a young daughter. How are you going to share pictures? And I said, well, if I need this, more people need this, and the world's getting bigger. And so we can do this and help people connect to their families. And, you know, we thought it turned into a decent business. It turned into a good exit before it got a chance to turn into a decent business, because that was the bubble. And, you know, the early internet conferences were like amazing. There was a guy named Dick Schaefer. He had a newsletter based out of New York. I can't remember the name of the newsletter right now, but he ran this conference. I'll never forget, in Burlingame. It was the first place I met Eric Schmidt when he was still at Sun Microsystems. He was pitching Java, and there were multiple standards, you know.
Amazing.
Ethernet had one or whatever it was. There was ATM. There was all this. And everything was kind of mashed together. There was the networking equipment. There was, we didn't know what to call the applications or websites. The Yahoo guys were there. A couple of years later, Bill Gurley, my partner, later at Benchmark, and Mary Meeker put on something called the Internet Summit. Yeah, we knew everyone there. There was like, I don't know how many people, not that many people there, a couple of hundred people there. I think it was in Laguna Niguel. And you knew everybody because it was a small club, and now it's everything. It's the world.
How did you find yourself in the club?
I made this investment in this company, and we got an investment. I did the first round, which is a story in of itself, the angel round, and then Benchmark and Oak did the second one, a guy named Ed Glassmeyer at Oak, and first Val Vaden, and then Bob Cagle at Benchmark. And so I got to meet people because you walked around talking about pictures on the internet, and it was like a novelty. We got invited to conferences.
About the internet. How does it start?
Oh, how did I know that? So this is...
This is 1995. You're saying that everybody knows everybody. How does Michael enter this brand new thing that just happens to explode later on?
So I had the benefit of not knowing anything about anything. So I get to Israel. I'm in the tech business because I was unemployed. That's a longer story than we have time for in a 20-minute thing. So I was unemployed. I couldn't get a job. I started something. That became like a merchant bank for tech. We had no money. We had some fees, Shlomo Kalish and I. And we backed Picture Vision. So everyone looked at this company, Picture Vision, in the early days of the internet and said, what's an internet in Israel? Because in 94, you kind of had the internet in the US, the end of 94, beginning of 95, but in Israel, hadn't really gotten here yet. My advantage was that when I was in college, we were a beta site for this thing called desktop publishing. We used something called Aldus PageMaker, which I don't know if it exists anymore, to publish our college newspaper because we had no money. Self-respecting college newspapers like the Harvard Crimson wouldn't use this thing at the time. And so we got a grant, actually, to try this thing out. And we sent it over a 2400 baud modem and prayed that call waiting wouldn't happen because that dropped the line. And we'd send the paper from where we were on 186th and Amsterdam Avenue in Manhattan down to FIT on 17th Street. We used to press send, hook up the modem, press send, say a prayer that it wouldn't fall.
Wow.
Get up, pray the next morning in synagogue in Yeshiva University, and then take the subway downtown to 17th Street to go see that the paper had landed there. So I knew what this thing kind of was, even if it wasn't called the internet at the time.
Wow.
And that was an advantage here.
Amazing. So you're with Benchmark, and then you're transitioning also to Aleph, and you're doing both.
Yeah, that's later. I joined Benchmark in 05. Yeah.
And so as you go through the years,
yeah,
what's changed?
So three things have changed. There's a lot of things that have changed, but one is I'm able to articulate today something I felt many years ago, which is I think in the 21st century, values generate value. We may not agree on what those values are. Different, you know, maybe climate change, it may be financial inclusion, it may be creating jobs, but brands in the 21st century are being built around values. So values create value. And therefore, I think, you know, my attachment to spirituality and to Judaism is an advantage in that. And I can articulate that as an economic value, an economic policy decision. I'm in the middle of a back and forth with an Israeli economist right now as to whether having children is good for the economy or bad for the economy right now. Israel's 3.1 births per family. It's very clear, in my view, that having children is good for the economy on three vectors. One is demographic growth increases demand. Number two, young people drive innovation. That's very clear. And number three, having children brings optimism.
There you go.
And optimism matters a lot for the economy and for a society. I'll argue that part of what's going on in the Western world right now is the decline in birth rate. It's not just harming the economy, it's harming optimism about the future.
What's amazing to me as I'm hearing you is that, you know, these are words that are not being said, you know, I don't think by, you know, by economists or by critical thinkers about, you know, whether one thing is good or not. You're talking about an intrinsic value and, you know, sort of a morphic idea, a theoretical idea of optimism, right?
It's not theoretical at all. I mean, many economists like Kahneman,
yeah,
have proven it. I don't think it's an accident, by the way, that Kahneman studied in the yeshiva when he was younger and came to this point of view about the psychological impacts on economic decisions. And so I'll say something a bit harsh right now, which is economists don't have skin in the game. Investors do. And so I'm judged by my outcomes. And if I'm wrong, I'm out of business. And so I need to bet on that innovation and that trend. So that's kind of, yes, what would change. So that's one thing that's changed. The second thing that's changed is I know a lot more people now than I did then. And I know that the most important thing in your career is your network, not your knowledge. You can learn lots of things. At Benchmark, they're the same. Learn it alls, not know it alls. But being a mensch, treating people right, and building a network, a reciprocal network of I'll help you if you help me, is the most valuable thing you can do early in your career.
What is being a mensch in the tech industry for you? What does that mean?
You know, the tech industry is super competitive, and you need to, on everything, for talent, for ideas, et cetera. I think one is you need to draw lines of what you're doing, but more importantly than that, far more importantly, is what will you do for somebody else? One of the things that most inspired me is we had a company here called Gigya that was attacked by the Free Syrian Army, a group of hackers. And we had a kind of competitor in Israel. They sent their guys who came out of the same army unit that you did to go help us defend ourselves against the attackers. That, to me, is amazing. That's a values-based system that's got strong roots. And so I think just turning up for people and building relationships is part of being a mentor. Professor Rosabeth Cantor at Harvard, who's a professor of leadership, says, I think, accurately, that kind of the first thing for leadership is turning up. And so many people don't turn up. You know, it's easy to turn up on Twitter and write 240 characters. It's difficult to turn up in person.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, so network really matters. And I know that in retrospect. I think the third thing that's changed for me, and this is, I guess, a privilege at this point, is I turned 50 this last week. And I really, for the last bunch of years, have decided I really only want to work with people I want to work with.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there could be the best idea in the world. If we're not going to enjoy talking and not going to have a dialogue, just not interested. And I'm sure there are a lot of great companies that will be built with people who I prefer not to hang out with, and that's totally cool. I'll stand by. I'll take a walk. I'll take a ball. It's fine. I don't have an anti-portfolio because I don't think about that.
Right.
I'm sure I miss a ton.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, you know, between the lines here, it all comes back to values. It comes back to this idea of why are we doing what we're doing? And it doesn't matter whether it's an investor, it's an entrepreneur, or whether it's in a garbage truck. It's the same idea that we're at the end, you know, there's a hierarchy of needs and there's a value system where camaraderie and...
The soul matters.
Soul matters.
You need a brain. It's the most powerful organ in the body, but the soul matters. And everybody has a soul. Otherwise, people wouldn't be offended.
Right. That's right. What have you learned about through the entrepreneurs that you've worked with? You've worked with both, you know, very young entrepreneurs with serial entrepreneurs. You've seen them grow and running businesses, employing thousands of people.
Yeah. Why matters? Simon Sinek says this. Why matters more than what? Why are we doing this? You can get people to do extreme things if you explain to them why. And in today's environment, where engineers are the scarce resource, they want to work on hard, impactful problems.
Yeah.
And so why matters a lot.
That's also a shift that's been happening.
No question. It's accelerating, in my view.
Yeah.
So that's in my view, super important.
Now, when I walk in, and I immediately, as I walk through the door, now if I see...
By the way, walking through the door, like our motto is exactly that, different is better than better, right? Which is we try to do things differently here.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm walking and I'm seeing you stand on the right.
Yeah.
Bright pink shirt.
Yeah.
In like a cubicle, not in a, you know, big...
No, I'm not in a cubicle. We're in an open space here with everyone.
In an open space, right. Yeah. A cubicle, for a young person, I don't even think about even the cubes. I think of it as a...
For me, cubicle is Dilbert. I don't do that.
I don't think I've even seen that in the real world. Yeah. But I'm walking in here and I'm trying to think, you know, there's something in the energy here that's different. There's something in the, I don't know what it is. When you created Aleph, and you're thinking through Aleph's vision, and you've been here for quite some time.
Yeah.
What is Aleph?
So last night we had a goodbye party for our office manager who's been with us almost a decade.
Wow.
And her name is Einav, and she's the heart and soul of Aleph. And we call her the chief happiness officer at Aleph. And she's been with me since before Aleph started. Now here's an amazing thing. All the Aleph employees since the beginning of Aleph turned up last night for Einav.
Really?
And so when we started Aleph, what we talked about, Ed and I, is we wanted to create a family, not just a venture firm. And so families have certain values. One is you stand up for people and you prefer their interests over your own. So we have a number of Aleph employees who have gone on to our portfolio companies, who have gone on to better and bigger careers, and we've supported them in that in a pretty meaningful way. Number two, you turn up for people personally, not just professionally. So the lines here between professional and personal are more blurred than what I think the Western bon ton would like you to have. And I think that's very Israeli, by the way, which is, and so, you know, we turn up for people's happy occasions and their sad occasions and if they need family and, you know, we're the family. And so that's super important to us. And three, since day one, Ed and I decided... Now, our other partners, Aaron, Yael, Tomer, that we were going to invest in the broader ecosystem. And even if it wasn't an Aleph company, we were going to make this ecosystem bigger on the notion from an investment perspective that a rising tide lifts all boats, on a values perspective that the robustness of this ecosystem as a whole in our small country matters a lot. And so we've given out free content, free seminars. We make a lot of our stuff available to people outside of our portfolio. And so that's been a huge value, and our team is motivated by that. And I think our team, if you ask them, thinks they're on a mission to, you know, make Israel and the Israeli tech ecosystem unbelievably powerful and successful.
We're talking about a bigger picture here.
Yes. It's all about bigger pictures. You know, this is the why. Why are we doing this? Well, we do this to make money for our LPs. That's our fiduciary duty. But we have a human duty, a national duty, a brotherhood duty to help other people. And that's a duty. It's not a right. It's a duty. We talk a lot more here about duties and responsibilities than we do rights. I'm not a giant believer in rights. I don't think rights come without responsibilities.
Michael, there's 10 more questions that I'm just beginning to think about, but it's 20 minutes, and I know how busy you are, and I have to get back to you. To making the country better and the world better, but I do have three...
In my portfolio companies, yeah.
Yes, I have three fun questions.
Yeah.
How about you? Favorite subject in middle school or high school?
I wasn't in class that much, but it was probably English writing.
English writing. What were you doing outside of class?
I was doing a lot of Jewish outreach across the United States, and I particularly worked with developmentally disabled at the time before they got the definition right. They were called mentally handicapped kids, and I did that up and down the East Coast to start, and then in kind of the middle of the country, Detroit, Cleveland, Columbus, and then in the South, Miami, Atlanta, Savannah, places like that. So I was out a lot.
Who would be somebody that inspires you, some sort of role model for you?
My wife. That's easy.
That's easy.
Yeah. You know, and my parents and my grandfather, who we discussed before we started doing this, who I was super close with and was an officer in the U.S. Navy in World War II. It was just a man of extreme integrity and duty.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I'm still going back to that, to the letter you showed.
Yeah.
And three
from
words.
From 1945.
1945.
Things don't change, yeah.
And three words you would use to describe yourself. If I were to ask Eden, Oron, Tomer, or Yael.
I don't know what the...
Who's Michael?
I don't know what to say. The one thing I would say, I feel deeply grateful to the people who have helped me along the way. Starting with my parents who decided to have me. That's actually, for maybe a broader conversation, it's a story that's come out around my 50th birthday. I've known it, but my parents told it finally. It was not a trivial decision. So super grateful. Second is ambitious, which is, I think, I just turned 50, as I mentioned. There's a lot more to do in this world that I'd like to do to make it a better place for our people and for the people of the world. Everyone deserves a shot. And number three, optimistic. I'm always optimistic.
I can see it in your eyes, honestly. It's pretty amazing. Michael, toda rabah.
Thank you.
Toda.